And I'm Bill Thomas, hosting Hear It Now today for Thursday, June 21st, 2012. We are on the summer solstice, and we've got an interesting program for you today. In the later half of the show, we turn into the oily show. First and last time I'll make that joke. But we'll be talking a lot about the Bakken, and we have some comments from a listener who heard us talking about it last week and had some comments of his own. He's somebody who works there and thought we didn't represent it very well and wanted to speak up. So I think you'll be interested in that. And then our Black Gold Boom reporter, Todd Melby, has a piece about rail, the growing importance of rail in moving oil out of the oil patch. But first, we're talking with someone who came by the studios this morning, Joao Valle de Almeida, and he is the ambassador to the United States from the European Union. He's Portuguese, but has served internationally for some time, been to the United States before. He has worked in the various forms of the European Union as it has evolved through the years in many capacities, high capacities, and is now the ambassador to the United States. And so we were very glad to have him in the studio here. Welcome to North Dakota and to Fargo.
Thank you very much. Very happy to be here.
One of the things I'm sure that our listeners are interested in is, what are your plans for this visit? I know you've already had some meetings this morning.
Yes, I'm here in Fargo for the day, or part of the day. Then I will travel to Bismarck, but I'll make a stop at Lisbon.
I heard that you're stopping in Lisbon because you're from Lisbon also, but the original Lisbon.
I'm from Lisbon across the Atlantic. On the other side of the Atlantic, I was born and raised in Lisbon, Portugal. And when I, spotted in the map of Lisbon in North Dakota, I said, well, I have to go there. And the mayor is kind enough to host me this afternoon.
That's good. That's good. They have a little plan to show you the town. It won't take very long. I've been there. So it's quite different from Lisbon, Portugal, I imagine.
Yeah, well, I don't expect to have the same Lisbon, but I'll be very happy to meet Lisbon, North Dakota.
Okay. You were appointed ambassador to the United States from the European Union about 2 years ago, is that
yeah,
right?
Yeah, almost 2 years ago,
And you are the first ambassador?
I'm the first ambassador of the European Union. We changed our sort of constitution very recently, and we decided to appoint people that represent the entire European Union. In all the countries in the world, we have about 140 delegations around the world.
I'm curious how that's working out because, of course, each of the individual countries, they have their ambassadors
Absolutely.
Who are here.
Absolutely.
I know there was even, some feeling among some of the countries, we don't need a European Union ambassador. We all have our own ambassadors. How are you able to work with the other countries and their delegations?
Extremely well. We meet on a regular basis. I chair and host the meetings of the ambassadors, 27 member countries, plus Croatia, who is about to join, and myself, so 29 people around the table. We have a lot in common. I mean, there's no other group of ambassadors in Washington that have so much in common as the EU ambassadors have, because we represent a group of countries that have decided to share their sovereignty in a number of areas, and increasingly so. So we have a common market, we have common rules, we have common policies, we have a single trade policy. We, European Union, negotiates on behalf of all the 27, all the trade deals around the world. We have a beginning of a foreign policy with a European sort of foreign minister, high representative for foreign policy and security, Cathy Ashton. And if you look at different issues, you will find that European member states have the same position on more than 90% of the issues, foreign policy or economics. And we take decisions collectively in a number of areas. So we have a very elaborated, very sophisticated system of regional integration. So it's only normal that when we represent ourselves outside, we also reflect this dual reality of member states, countries that are sovereign, but also European Union as such, because we have a lot in common.
Mm-hmm. And what do you see as your role in the United States? I realize your job must have a lot of variety and many different things that you work with.
Yeah.
But what are the most important things that you see as your place as an ambassador to the United States from the European
Union? Well, first
Union?
Of all, to promote and preserve the interests of the European Union as such in close cooperation with my fellow ambassadors from the member states. Secondly, to enhance the visibility of the European Union and to enhance the relevance of the European Union for the United States. And, you know, it's enough to quote a few figures or have in mind a few facts. First, that together we represent about 50% of world's GDP, mm-hmm. one-third of world's trade. That the European Union is by far the most important trade and investment partner of the United States. We are the biggest investor in the U.S. Americans are the biggest investor in the European Union. Our companies are, sometimes it's difficult to say if one is European or American because they are so interconnected, so interlinked. We have common values, democracy, human rights, individual freedom, rule of law. This unites us very strongly. And last but not least, we have a common history, common roots. Here in North Dakota, you know, people coming from Germany, Sweden, Norway, you know, that is a very solid foundation for our relationship. So it's part of my role to make it more visible, make it more, you know, better understood by the American public opinion, the American politicians. So I engage a lot with Congress, with the administration, with business people, with universities, and I want to get out of Washington because I don't think that one can do it so properly in representing the Union in this country if one does not know the country. And that's why I'm in North Dakota now.
Well, you mentioned trade, and North Dakota has become very well known lately as an energy-producing state because of the oil that's coming out of the western part of the state. But agriculture is still the biggest part of our economy in North Dakota. Do you have any specific things that you're trying to accomplish in terms of trade while you're here?
I had a good discussion this morning with the North Dakota Trade Office. I will discuss with the mayors. I will discuss with responsible people in the administration in Bismarck. I will see the Secretary of State. I think my message is clear. I mean, we are very interested to see how North Dakota is progressing, not only in the traditional sectors like agriculture, but also in the newer sectors like energy, shale gas, and all that. And, you know, number one concern today for politicians around the world, particularly in the U.S. and the European Union, is growth and jobs. If North Dakota is doing a good job about that, I think it's important to try to understand. But my main message would be let's engage across the Atlantic. Let's see what we can do together to improve job creation, economic growth, finding jobs for our young people. I know this is not a major concern in North Dakota. You have a lower unemployment than the average in the United States, which makes another reason for me to come over and see how you manage that. But overall, I think we need all to try to push forward a more aggressive, more ambitious trade and investment agenda across the Atlantic. And I'm very hopeful that the efforts that we are developing on both sides will produce results in the near future.
I'm talking to João Valle de Almeida, who is the ambassador from the European Union to the United States. Ambassador Valle de Almeida, the G20 summit was recently concluded, and what are your feelings about what was accomplished there? I'm thinking particularly in terms of the economic and currency problems in Europe.
You know, the G20 makes a lot of sense. It was at leaders' level created after the financial crisis when we were trying to deal with the effects of the financial crisis. And it's proved to be a very good forum for leaders of the most important economies in the world to first realize that they have a lot in common, that the world is now a global economy, so what happens in one part of the planet affects the other. And secondly, to try to find solutions for these problems and try to ensure the conditions for sustainable growth. This is what the G20 is about, bringing together the industrialized countries of the sort of world, old world, like Europe and the U.S., together with emerging economies and developing economies. So this is the right forum for us to try to find global solutions for global problems. One of the issues, of course, there was how can we make sure that the world does not, or to make sure that the world engages in a positive economic cycle, that we have sustainable recovery, sustainable growth in a balanced way.
Do you think that enough happened? I mean, many of the commenters on the summit felt that it did not take real decisive action.
Yeah, people are always frustrated by summits. Of course, we cannot expect every summit to be an historical occasion for historic decisions. I think the most important is that people keep meeting and keep talking and keep discussing these issues. We don't want people to get isolated and think that, you know, the other country's problem is not my problem. At the end of the day, it is. And if there is one lesson that we can draw from this a couple of years of financial crisis, is that we are in this together and we need to find solutions. In Los Cabos, the most recent summit, of course, Europe was one of the issues of discussion, but it's not the only one. I mean, if you look at the situation in China, the economy is slowing down. If you look at India or Brazil, same kind of problems. Mm-hmm. I don't need to mention the issues in the United States where people are afraid that the recovery will be a sort of jobless recovery or where the levels of unemployment will remain relatively high. And I don't need to mention the situation in Europe where we are struggling with the aftershocks of the financial crisis, trying to solve some individual countries' problems and preventing them from having a major impact in our overall system. All this was discussed in Los Cabos. I think there was a sense that we need to find solutions, that each of the members of the G20 has to contribute to finding those solutions. And I think it was a good summit from that point of view. It didn't bring the solutions for all the problems. That will be hard to expect. But I sense the responsibility on the part of the leaders that is absolutely necessary if you want to overcome this situation.
You mentioned the interconnectedness of nations, and of course, North Africa has seen a lot of change. Currently, the world's attention is focused on Syria, and we sometimes forget in the United States how closer things together are, in a sense, that Syria is not so far away from Europe. What do you see of what's happening there?
We are very worried, as you know. We are trying to find the solutions for this problem. We believe that President Assad must go away. We need to find solutions to stop violence, first and foremost, deal with the humanitarian situations that we have there, and find alternative solutions. But we believe also that we need to do this in an international framework, preferably the United Nations. So we're looking for a consensus in the Security Council around what Kofi Annan is doing. There's this idea now of a contact group, which we support. We work hand in hand with the United States. Our High Representative Cathy Ashton and Secretary Clinton have met a number of times. Our leaders have discussed this in the margins of the G20 summit, which is another good thing about the G20, is that it provides opportunities for direct contacts among leaders. And there's a lot going on as we speak in diplomatic terms to try to find the right way forward for Syria. But you are absolutely right. Syria is in our backyard, as the whole Mediterranean region is in our backyard. I don't need to mention Egypt or Tunisia or Libya as cases in which a lot is being played. I think it's very important that what Zbigniew Brzezinski calls the global awakening, that populations are basically saying we want to determine our future, that they want democracy, that young people want access to freedom of choice and freedom of speech. All this is very important. I think we should support these movements in this particular region, and Europe is doing so politically, but also financially. But we need also to be clear about the responsibilities of the leaders, and we need to say that we are ready to support, provided, of course, that the path is one that is a democratic one, that respects human rights. This is what is at stake in the Mediterranean region, apart from more sort of strategic aspects, mm-hmm. because the region is, as it by itself, a very sensitive one for all sorts of reasons that we know.
Right. Okay. Thank you for taking on these serious topics. I want to ask you a question that maybe not quite as serious, but you mentioned you're from Lisbon, Portugal. You're visiting Lisbon, North Dakota. What do you find most different about living in the United States, being someone from Europe, from Portugal?
Well, it's very different, I would say. It's a different country, but it's a very diverse country. I think the first thing I would stress is the diversity. And when you travel around this country, you see how different the states are, how, you know, the landscape, the climate, but also people and their origins, the cultural background they have, the way they live. And so it's always a great experience to, discover a new state like North Dakota now and see how different you are. And at the same time, how similar you are, because there's a lot in common across the United States. I always find a lot of energy and a lot of sense of initiative, hope in the future. And I think this is something that sometimes we like to see a little bit more in Europe. The belief that tomorrow can even be better than today. Sometimes in Europe we tend to be a little bit too pessimistic. I think we could import a little bit of optimism from you over here. Although, of course, when I travel around the United States, I also see a number of problems, and unemployment being one of them. There's a talk about the crisis of the middle class and the American dream. So I very much like to discuss all these topics with my interlocutors, and I hope to be doing some of these discussions here in North Dakota as well. Although people tell me that there is no crisis here, so it's very well, good to come to a place where people are even more optimistic than the average.
There's certainly not an employment problem here. I wouldn't say there's no problems with growth. There often come things that are part of growth that are difficult, and we've certainly talked with people about some of those problems here in the past. But yes, economically, North Dakota is an unusual spot in the United States right now, and hope you enjoy your time here.
I'm enjoying it a lot up to now, and I'm looking forward to the next 2 days.
All right. I've been talking to Ambassador João Valle de Almeida. He is the ambassador from the European Union to the United States and visiting North Dakota this week. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
And we'll have Tom Eason in just a moment talking about an old sentimental song right after this.
Support for this program is provided by the North Dakota Education Association, an organization of 8,000 school employees working to ensure great public schools for every child.
Tonight's television lineup on Prairie Public starts with the This Old House Hour. Then at 8 Central, the British comedy Doc Martin. And at 9, Mother Nature in Charge, Devil's Lake Life Stories, followed at 9:30 by Steamboats on the Red. Tune in tonight on Prairie Public.
Back in the olden days of telephony, before mobile phones and cell phones, before push-button phones and wireless phones, even before dial phones, you picked up the telephone and you said, "Hello, Central," to get the attention of the central operator, who would then connect you manually to your party. And Tom Eason, history professor, goes digging back into those old days looking for the origin of a song that he inherited that used that telephone catchphrase.
There are people who get hard or gruff as they get older. And there are others, a greater number, I think, who get more sentimental as the years go by. I don't remember my grandmother being the sentimental type. If you recall that Mary and Martha thing from the New Testament, well, she was a Martha type. And yet I know Grandma once had a sentimental side, because I have an old school composition book of hers, and it's full of sad old songs. This isn't what we call a ballad book. It's not that complete. It's just a group of songs brought home from school, I think. The saddest of them is Hello Central, Give Me Heaven. Now, you can guess the story just from the title. A widower and his little girl are telling one another how much they miss dear Mama, who has gone to heaven. The little girl, therefore, announces she's going to ring up heaven and get her mother on the telephone. There ensues the tear-jerking chorus. Hello, Central, give me heaven, for my mama's there. You will find her with the angels on the golden stair. She'll be glad it's me who's talking. Call her, won't you, dear? For surely I want to tell her we're so lonely here. Over at Central, of course, the operator takes pity on the little girl and tells her over the line, yes, dear heart, I'll soon come home. Now, I recognize the words of the song, but I always identified them with the Carter family, pioneers of the country music recording industry. Sure enough, I find recordings of the Carters singing Hello Central, and it is attributed to A.P. Carter. That makes no sense, though, because my grandmother had to have penned these stanzas prior to 1905, long before the Carters were in the music business. Researching further, I find that the popular version sung by the Carters and by other country musicians, including Ferlin Husky, who I don't think I've thought about in 40 years, is a later adaptation of a song originally composed by a popular songwriter a generation earlier, by Byron G. Harlan in 1901. He published sheet music of it and also issued a wax cylinder recording. Harlan's greatest hit, for which he's most remembered, was After the Ball. The old Harlan wax recording of Hello Central, Give Me Heaven is almost painful to listen to, not because of the sentimentality of the song, but because the music is so bad. The vocalization is sorry, and the little wind orchestra accompanying the singer is overwrought. The later recordings by the Carter family are much more pleasing, and they also smooth out the difficult intervals in the tune. I have no evidence that any of my people had an Edison phonograph. Perhaps they did, or perhaps Grandma got hold of the sheet music, but it's more likely she learned the song by ear from her teacher. Lest you think Grandma was awash in sentimental tears, I'll mention that the next song in her book was Marching Through Georgia.
Well, we'll march through North Dakota. Coming up later in the show, we have What's Happening, where, as usual on Thursday, we run down a few events around the state. There's always too many to get all of the good ones, but we try to highlight some that we think you might find interesting. I'm going to mention one now, though. I'm going to take the privilege of the fact that this is a Prairie Public event and mention it early. A week from tomorrow, on Friday, there's an event in Williston called the Williston Blast. It's, you know, just kind of one of those community celebrations. You folks in Williston know about it, with a breakfast in the morning and booths from different community organizations and blues and barbecue and bands in the afternoon. Well, we will be there with a Prairie Public booth out in front of Books on Broadway, one of our supporters in Williston. We'll be in front of Books on Broadway. We'll have a root beer keg. We'll be handing out free root beer in Prairie Public cups that you can take home for your very own, and having a good time talking to you, we hope. And Todd Melby, our Black Gold Boom reporter, will be there for part of the day with his microphone. He can answer questions and talk to you about the Black Gold Boom project, and also maybe record stories from you or comments from you about what's going on with this whole project, about how oil is changing the face of North Dakota. And I find that most North Dakotans have an opinion about that, even if they don't live in the oil boom area. But in Williston, people certainly have many thoughts about it. And so that will be an interesting time. So we hope that you might be willing to come out and say hello to us in front of Books on Broadway in Williston a week from Friday. We'll be out there 9 to 4. And we'd be pleased to see you if you could come by. All right. The news is next. After the news, we will be going on in topic to the oil boom area with a couple of pieces. One, a man who operates a trucking company in Williston, talking about his work there and spills, and then Todd Melby about rails and oil after this news. You're listening to Hear It Now, and I'm Bill Thomas, hosting today. And I happened to be hosting also last Friday when, as usual on Fridays, Dave Thompson, our news director, came on to discuss the week's news. And one of the things that we discussed was a report from a news website called ProPublica. And this report was an investigative report about spills in the Bakken area and what happened with them and regulation of them and so on. And so we discussed that report and talked about some of the stories about those things. Well, after we went off the air, we got a phone call from a person who actually owns and operates a trucking company in the Bakken and was a listener. And he felt that our conversation had really misrepresented how things were. He didn't deny that spills happened there, but he thought we had really given a wrong impression. He noted that we surely weren't out there ourselves, which is true, we're not. And he had enough to say about it that I asked him if he'd mind if we recorded his conversation, because I thought you would be interested also in hearing the perspective of someone like him who's, you know, working and doing a job every day in the Bakken in the trucking industry. So he agreed. His name is Andy Alvarado, and we began by asking him how long he'd been in North Dakota.
I've been up here almost 4 years.
Uh-huh. And what's your business?
I own a small trucking business, MSLA Trucking. We do water and winch, production water, fresh water, flowback, and all the heavy water stuff that they use in fresh water also.
Now, you got in touch with us because you heard us talking on the air about a report that came out about spills in the oil patch and kind of got your back up a little bit. Why don't you tell me about how your company and, you know, how you guys work with spills?
Well, with the companies that I've worked with, I'm currently leased on with Cascade Tanks, and we have a very strict spill policy, like most of the oil companies do. All the big oil companies have they're notorious for spill policies. It's pretty much a zero tolerance, nothing on the ground, even as far as fresh water is concerned. You may remember a couple of years back they had an incident with Wiley Bice. Somebody claimed that he was spilling on the road, or he was just dumping on the road.
Right.
Which I really don't believe that any of the drivers would do that. He's got very strict policies against that. As I said, most companies do. They don't want nothing on the ground whatsoever. And when they do get something on the ground, they usually attack it immediately, you know, to clean up or whatever actions has to be taken.
Uh-huh. So tell me how that works. Like explain how you tell that to the drivers and how you expect the drivers to act and how you keep track of it.
Basically, what I have with my drivers, I have a zero tolerance with my drivers. I have zero tolerance on spills. I have incident reports that need to be filled out if there is a spill. I have, that has to also be reported to the dispatchers and also has to be reported to the company guys. If you have a spill on site, if you're doing production water, you know, our policies are contact a dispatcher right away, pull your hoses, close all your valves. If you pull your hose off your tank, make sure that your tank is completely shut down. And also make sure that if you do drop anything on the ground, if you're using a vac trailer, then pick it up right away. Or have them contact somebody else and have that water picked up right away.
So
off the ground.
So it sounds like your what you call your spill policy, it's pretty detailed. It's not just like, hey, guys, no spills, but you got detailed procedures, what people are supposed to do and everything.
Yeah, we're required to carry what they call the spill kits, and that's in case you have to dike everything up. I don't know if you were out there here last week or so ago, then you'll notice that there's bigger dikes built around the pads now because of all the rain and the flood that we had last year. You know, a spill is a spill, and, you know, some of the water's got oil in it, some of the water's got, you know, it's H2S water, or, you know, depends on where you're at and what they're picking up.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's pretty company wide through just about any of the companies. You know, it's pretty standard procedure, I guess you could call it.
And you've dealt with a lot of the big companies, so you feel pretty confident in saying that?
Yeah, I feel confident. Yeah, you deal with enough company guys and they walk up to you and, you know, and then you know, you have your weekly safety meetings anyway, and, you know, spills are always a concern. You know, I was totally unfamiliar with the oil industry until I come out here, but I was involved with tankers and gasoline and diesel, you know, delivering hot oil and, and whatever. Those guys are extremely strict on the same thing. So, you know, it's pretty much industry-wide, you know, with anything that happens, you have to call it in. It's a hazardous material. You know, they haven't rated waters that way yet, but, you know, I don't doubt that someday they will.
How do you feel about, you know, the state of North Dakota and their folks and how they deal with it?
What I've seen the state handle things pretty well. You know, I don't think the state was ready for as much action as there is out here.
I think everybody could agree about that.
I don't think, you know, DOE was ready for it. I don't think anybody was prepared for what was going to happen, you know, but as far as reaction and as far as how things are going or how things are represented through the state, I think the state's doing a pretty good job for what we have.
Hey, you were telling me before we were on the air that really more of a concern was general safety. Explain to me again about how the drivers are paid and what effect that has.
A lot of drivers are paid. They get paid percentage. Some drivers get paid hourly. Some guys get paid by the barrel. And I think that affects safety because now you have a guy that gets paid by the barrel. He's going to overload his truck. He's going to speed down the roads. I've been trucking for over 30 years, and this is probably the most unsafe area I've ever seen as far as truck turn. DOT, I see, is stepping up and doing patrols. And then I can see that even the state or the county vehicles, they're carrying portable scales also to start catching these guys that run late at night, that run overweight, just dangerous driving. And a lot of that's due to the fact that the way the pay structures are set up through a lot of these companies, whether it be my own company or whether it be Cascade or Wiley Bice or Park Fuels or Missouri Basin, you know. And when a guy gets in a hurry, then he doesn't pay attention to what he's doing. I forget what the death rate was last year just in trucks. It's an unsafe area, I feel. For the counties to get involved, that's a good thing. You see those guys out more. You see the state patrol out more often at night. You see DOT out more often, you know. And I think that's a good thing. You know, I mean, if you don't run safe equipment, don't run your trucks. If you don't have safe drivers, don't hire them, you know. I think the industry itself has to come up with their own policies as far as keeping control over some of these drivers that just come in and have no experience, period.
Well, what do you do? What, like, in terms of, you know, checking out your trucks, inspecting them, qualifying your drivers, and so on?
Well, we're required daily by law to inspect our trucks, to do our walk-arounds, and to check everything. As far as my drivers are concerned, usually I'm pretty good with drivers. As far as a safe driver on the road, you're required to take them out on a test drive. And you can usually tell probably within the first 5 minutes of driving or sometimes even before you leave the parking lot whether the guy's going to make it or not. You know, and then you rely on your friends out there in the field to go, hey, I seen your gold truck speeding, or hey, I saw your other truck speeding, or, you know, hey, I saw these unsafe practices. I usually get a phone call. Well, drivers out here, a lot of companies, they want a minimum of 2 years experience. They want a minimum oil patch experience of 6 months. And, you know, you can always tell by looking at your equipment, you know, what's breaking on your trucks or what's not breaking on your trucks as to how a guy's handling your trucks on the road. You can always tell that, especially off-road.
Since you've been here a few years now, how have you seen things change over time in terms of these different things?
It used to be said that if they had a pulse, they got a job, you know, and it's still said out here as far as you got a driver's license, you got a job for a lot of these companies. What I've seen change out here is just the amount of traffic. As you guys talked about over in Williston, down in Dickinson, up in the Stanley area, the amount of traffic is just, it's just tenfold, you know, from when I first come out here. And that just creates unsafe conditions. Inexperienced guys dispatching. I had problems with one company. They kept dispatching inexperienced guys to what they call a hot well, H2S well. I mean, you know, what's the first thing the guy does? He opens that tank and he sticks his face in it, looking, you know, to look inside and see what the levels are. H2S gas hits him, it'll kill him, you know. And it's just a lack of experience, just lack of experience out here. They're so desperate for drivers that anybody can get a job, pretty much.
Uh-huh. How is it, without getting into anything, you know, confidential or anything, I mean, how have you seen things work financially? Is it rates going up, going down over the time? How's that been for you and for the industry that you see?
The rates have pretty much been the same. A couple other companies, they've gone to strictly barrel rate and very little hourly rate work done. But for production or for hauling into like an open pit or, you know, freshwater pit, a lot of that stuff is by the barrel now. There's a lot of companies that still will pay by the hour, you know, but you pretty much just have to keep your guys honest and, you know, nobody fudging tickets and stuff like that. You know, I mean, a guy can still make a decent living out here, but I've seen a lot of guys going broke because there's so many people up here and there's so many trucks up here and so many companies up here, and the whole area is just overwhelmed.
Uh-huh.
So some guys, I know there's some companies that are going in and starting to underbid. I know some of the big national companies are coming in here, like down in the Dickinson area. And then, like I said, you can still make a good living, but it's just a matter of how you're going to handle things, handle your drivers, handle your equipment, handle the companies, you know, what a guy's going to do and not do.
One of the things we always hear is that it's hard to find place for people to live. Do you ever try to help your guys with that, or how's that go?
Yeah, I usually try to help my guys. I used to put them up in my, I got a small apartment in Minot, and I used to put them up in Minot. And I had another trailer out there in Blaisdell. You know, we try to find places. I got a couple other friends with trailer spots, or I try to help them with, either with fuel or I try to help them with housing either way. But yeah, housing is it's a real challenge out here.
Here, let me ask you a question, and you can, you can pass on this one if you want to, but I'm just curious, if you were the governor or, you know, in state government, what do you think would be the most important thing to do in terms of, you know, in terms of the oil patch?
Traffic safety should be the number one priority out here. Yeah, I know that they hired more state troopers. I know that some of the sheriff's departments have hired more deputies. I understand it takes a while to train them. You know, there has to be more traffic safety. You see some of the trucks come down from north and they'll hot rod up and down the roads, overweight to get up and into up across the border.
These are from Canada you're talking about?
Yeah. You know, you get certain companies down here. I've driven, like I said, I've been out here almost 4 years, and I've driven, day shift, I've driven night shift, and there just has to be more patrol out there. It just simply does. It's just dangerous. Mm-hmm. Dangerous. You can drive down Highway 8 where they're fixing new stuff and got guys hot rodding up and down that road, and speed limit's still 45 in places, 25 in others. You get guys going 75, 80 miles an hour. I understand that, you know, it's not the funds that aren't available, it's the personnel that's not available. Yeah, that would be a number one.
All right. Well, thanks a lot for taking this time.
Sure. Thank you so much.
That was Andy Alvarado, head of a trucking company, who wanted to give his perspective on how things operate and what's important out there in the Bakken. Of course, we know there's a lot of different perspectives about that, and we hope to hear from many of you as time goes by. Roughnecks, truckers, entrepreneurs of every stripe are cashing in on North Dakota's oil boom, and so is an industrial giant from the 19th century, the railroads. Black Gold Boom reporter Todd Melby has the story on how trains are being used to move crude out of the Bakken to refineries hundreds of miles away.
Drilling rigs are the most visible sign of the oil boom. The tall, thin structures stand out on the western prairie like birthday candles on a sheet cake. After about a month of noisy, dirty work drilling a hole, the oil starts flowing. A grasshopper-shaped pumper replaces the drilling rig. This machine churns day and night, sucking oil out of the ground. quickly filling up nearby tanks. Now, normally from the tanks, the oil would be piped to refineries in Louisiana, Texas, Illinois, and other places. But the pipelines aren't finished yet. That causes oil companies to look for alternatives to pipelines. Jack Ekstrom works for Whiting Petroleum.
Once you've discovered the crude, your royalty owners want to be paid. You obviously want to sell the production so that you can take the cash that you receive for that and complete the development. So it is by necessity that you will find the means, whatever that means is, to get that crude to market.
It may be years before enough new pipelines are built to serve the Bakken. So in the meantime, a lot of crude oil from North Dakota is being shipped by train. Canadian Pacific and Burlington Northern Santa Fe, also known as BNSF, have beefed up operations in western North Dakota. In 2011 alone, BNSF added more than 460 people to its North Dakota payroll. Tom Williams is the top salesman for BNSF's Industrial Products Division.
You know, on any given day, you can ship virtually anywhere in North America through the rail system.
To make that possible, BNSF and Canadian Pacific have built 9 new oil loading terminals in western North Dakota, and that's just in the past 2 years. In addition, BNSF is planning to open 3 more oil loading terminals by the end of 2013. BNSF's Rangeland Terminal at Epping, located just east of Williston, has commitments to carry 100,000 barrels of oil daily. That's about 1/6 of North Dakota's current daily output. Moving oil by rail is a lot more expensive than pipelines, which is probably why all this talk of railroads seems to make Jack Ekstrom of Whiting rather grumpy.
You'd rather not have to do rail, but if you have no alternatives and it becomes a matter of being able to transport the crude, obviously you would build a rail facility.
Tom Williams of BNSF believes that even after oil pipelines are built, his railroad will hang on to market share.
We really think there's a long-term play for rail, and clearly as pipeline expands, they'll have a position and they'll have their share, but we don't see that completely pushing rail out of the equation. We offer the value of being able to get the oil directly to refineries.
In the meantime, North Dakota is poised to pump up its oil infrastructure. Governor Jack Dalrymple hosts a pipeline summit this week in Bismarck. For Prairie Public and the Black Gold Boom Oil Series, I'm Todd Melby.
This series is produced by independent producer Todd Melby and brought to you by Prairie Public and Local Lore, a national initiative produced by AIR, the Association of Independents and Radio Incorporated, and with financial support from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Wincote Foundation, the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, the National Endowment for the Arts, and the Spence Law Firm.
Arts programming on Prairie Public is supported in part by the North Dakota Council on the Arts, a state agency developing, promoting, and supporting the arts in North Dakota.
What's going on? What's going on? What's going on? Yeah, what's going on? Oh, what's going on? What's going on?
Well, there's plenty going on this weekend. There seem to be a number of community festivals going on. It's going to be that way through the rest of the summer. In Williston, the Upper Missouri Valley Fair is happening at the fairgrounds north of Williston. In Minot, today, the Voices of Note at Arts in the Park at Scandinavian Heritage Park. Tomorrow, the Bismarck Art and Galleries Association has their summer solstice party. Go to their website to find out more about it. This weekend, Blues on the Red in Grand Forks, 6 to 10 p.m. in Town Square. The food and beer garden, lawn chairs welcome. This Saturday, Corey Stevens with the Shuffle Cats happening there. In Devil's Lake, it is this weekend is the 36th annual Devil's Lake Walleye Fishing Tournament. In Grafton, their Summerfest, Watford City, their Home Fest. It's in Medora. It's the Cowboy Hall of Fame Induction Weekend. Plus, they're having an Art in the Park sale there on Saturday as well. And here's one of my favorite ones, a volunteer opportunity. You can volunteer to be a mock emergency victim at Hector International Airport in Fargo. CAS Fargo Emergency Management is having this on June 22nd from 8 a.m. to 11 a.m. You get to pretend that you're injured and help train law enforcement, fire departments, emergency medical technicians, and National Guard members. If you want to do that, contact Volunteer Center Services. 235-2476. Now, that's an unusual opportunity, but there's so many things going on this summer. Be sure to check culturepulse.org, check your local newspaper, online lists. There's so much happening. It's just be a shame not to get out and enjoy it, hear some music, see some art, go to activities, and join some other people. A few things that are happening in our area.
This is Dakota Datebook for June 21st. Today's datebook examines the story of a baseball game played on this date, June 21st, 1913, when Jose Mendez, a Hall of Fame Cuban pitcher, played in the small town of Havana, North Dakota. All nations defeated Havana, the Fargo Forum noted, 5-4 in a fast 10-inning game. The All Nations Ball Club was a barnstorming team comprised of men from many nations, including Chinese, Japanese, Indians, Hawaiians, and Americans. Jose Mendez, born in Cuba in 1887, became an international star in 1910 when he beat the touring Philadelphia Athletics in Cuba. Mendez also won a pitching duel against Christy Mathewson's New York Giants in 1911 and gained renown as the Black Diamond. Mendez was not very big, just 5'10" and weighing 152 pounds, but he had an arm like a cannon. In the summers of 1913, 14, and 16, Mendez toured with the All Nations team, traveling by private railway car and spending about 4 weeks in North Dakota. Town teams were eager to play the All Nations team because fans loved to see the international group of pros in action. The owner of the All Nations team, J.L. Wilkinson, arranged for a June 18th game in Havana, located in Sargent County near the South Dakota border. Jose Mendez started the game and pitched 8 innings, allowing 4 runs. The game went to extra innings, but the All Nations team scored in the top of the 10th to secure the win. The All Nations team played other games in North Dakota that summer against the likes of Jamestown, Devil's Lake, and Cooperstown on their way to a record of 124 wins and only 21 losses. Mendez later starred for the Kansas City Monarchs in the Negro League in the 1920s. In 2006, he was posthumously admitted to baseball's Hall of Fame. How odd it was that in 1913, a Cuban Hall of Fame pitcher would play in Havana. Not Havana, Cuba, but Havana, North Dakota. But the story gets even more intriguing because the All Nations team played a doubleheader in Cooperstown on August 1, 1913. Who could ever have imagined that a black pitcher from Cuba would play in Cooperstown, North Dakota, and later gain entrance to the Hall of Fame in Cooperstown, New York? Dakota Datebook is a production of Prairie Public in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, funded by the North Dakota Humanities Council. For more information or to listen anytime, go to prairiepublic.org. Today's Dakota Datebook was written by Stephen Hoffbeck. I'm Merrill Pepcorn.
And by the way, I feel I should remind you, you can always go and hear a Hear It Now program online. Go to prairiepublic.org, the radio page, click the pull-down menu, click on Hear It Now, and it'll take you to the archive. You can listen to past programs going back quite a ways. But think of future programs, as in tomorrow, Jasper Schneider, USA Rural Development Director, will be here. His ND 2.0 report just came out, and they'll be talking a little bit about the development of that report. And as usual on Fridays, Dave Thompson will be here to talk over the week's news and get a little perspective on some of the stories that have been happening during the week. Movie review and Dakota Datebook tomorrow on Hear It Now. Meanwhile, there's more great programming ahead on Prairie Public, so stay with us.